said.
Don't believe what I just saw.
I'm a man. I'm 40.
This is John Sheezer. I'm here.
Eric Marino.
Eric.
No,
I gotta tell you about the Clippers.
I'm an addict.
Sportsaholics, I gotta.
Let's just hope this shit doesn't go viral.
Okay. Welcome back to Sportsaholics. This is episode number 155. The Junior Seau, legendary Chargers linebacker, 10-time All-Pro, 12-time Pro Bowl selection, selected to the 90s All-Decade team, played 13 seasons. If you remember, committed suicide, unfortunately, back in 2012, but was one of the first to have his brains examined for the CTE concussion, protocol. Was one of the, unfortunately, one of the guys that kind of led into that that whole development of learning that concussions can cause severe damage. And unfortunately, he lost his life to help do that. I mean, like he had dedicated, or he was like, that was part of a suicide. He shot himself so that in the chest, so his brain wouldn't get injured, so they could look at it. But anyway, great player. I know. I remember just growing up. For some reason, my younger brother loved Junior Seau. So when anytime I got a Junior Seau card, I knew I could just trade it to him. It upped the value immensely just because I could. I was like, all right, he doesn't have this one. I'm gonna hit him for a Jordan. That and David Robinson, for some reason, love that guy too. But anyway, this is, like I said, episode 155. We've got actually an awesome episode. I've got Joe Bartnick from the Puck Off podcast. He's going to be on later. Just kind of wrapping up just real quickly the first third of the NHL season, what you should be watching. And of course you can listen to his show, Puck Off Podcast, find it on iTunes, Stitcher, all that stuff. I think at least once a week. I see them all. They're very active on Twitter. So anyway, he'll be on later. And we've got Eric coming in from New York. He'll be on later on this episode. So I know he's very, very busy. I hope you guys are watching SNL, supporting as I do. Very funny episode this past weekend, but it's been kind of a busy week in sports. Baseball finally picked up. I mean, I feel so bad this past month for like MLB Network or like Baseball Tonight people. They just, it's the same thing every night, just nothing happening, minor league deals, little this, little that, and then finally, all within like a 36 hour period, Ohtani signs with the Angels, which, that's cool. I mean, I'm sure this guy's great, but, Major League Baseball is a whole different thing. And look, that it's happened. There's been a lot of success stories coming over from Japan. I'm not saying he won't be one of them, but what I'm saying is he'll be an all-star. Look, that's a given just from the popularity standpoint, the international vote and all that kind of stuff, but I wish him nothing but the best. I'm just not putting the ceiling that high is all I'm saying. But I do want him to pitch and bat as a DH in the same game. Just I love when weird stuff in baseball happens. That's part of my sports, like my sports addiction is just anomalies in just a repetitive event that happens all over the time. Little things that are different. That's where I get my kicks, if you will. But and then immediately following the good old Stanton to the Yankees, which is fantastic if you are a Yankees fan, and horrific if you're a fan of baseball in general. There's going to be so many Yankees games on television over the next 8 years. Just prepare your children. I recommend just very subtle back-talking of the Yankees, how I mean, buying the team thing is kind of old, but just, you know, Yankees fans are dicks. And look, Yankees fans, you're passionate. And the rest of New York sports right now is not that great. And so this is a lifeboat that came by and that might save New York sports. It's been really bad over there. I know the Mets made it recently, but you know, my Royals took care of that, but I don't know. They'll sell out everywhere. I mean, I'll go watch it. It's going to be crazy. I feel really sorry for pitchers. They just got to stay healthy. That's the main thing on that one. But as I mentioned a couple episodes ago, my grandfather recently passed away, 97-year-old, huge baseball fan, and definitely hated the Yankees. So that's one. He didn't have to see this. Like, this would have just made him absolutely, absolutely sick. Guys, real quick, before we get into Joe Bartnick, talk a little bit of NHL hockey. If you guys need any shirts printed up, basketball jerseys, softball, family reunions, just anything, go to UnionPressKC.com. UnionPressKC.com. They'll take care of you there. Also, if you're hungry, you like drinking beer, try eating beer. Go to regrained.com. Delicious, like hiking trail bars. I guess I don't know how to describe the thing, but they take actual grains from beers in the brewing process, and they mix them with honey, oats, all this stuff. I mean, you got to go. That's why. Just go to regrained.com. REGRAINED. They're delicious. I know that. Both flavors I've tried, very good. So go there. I know they got a discount going right now when you go to the website. And if you're in Southern California, San Diego, La Jolla area, as I was just a week and a half ago, go to Don Carlos Taco Shop on Pearl Street, Kitty Catty Corner from the world-famous Comedy Store. Delicious. Follow them online, Twitter, Instagram, at Eat a Burrito. I've been a big fan of them for years. So if whether you live down there or you're vacationing down there, which a lot of you do, or if you don't, you should. That part of Oceanside, South, Southern, that part of California is awesome. So definitely give that a try that out. And when you're doing that, go to Don Carlos Taco Shop, eat a burrito. Okay, when we get back from break, Joe Bartnick from the Puck Off podcast, very funny comedian, is going to be with us. And I figured a very appropriate, a band called Hockey. Going in to the interview, coming out of our interview. Band's called Hockey. Great. As promised, we are back. Our next guest you can see at the Irvine Improv December 29th. So Southern California, if you're in that area, Orange County, LA, go check it out. The host of the Puck Off podcast, Joe Bartnick. Welcome back to Sportsaholics. How are you doing, man?
Fantastic. Fantastic. How are you?
You know what? I've got really bad sports fever right now. I went to a Clippers game the other night just because it was cheap, and I was like, you know what, I just want to go see live sporting events. I'm thinking about going back in a couple days, but then I started looking up in the rafters, and they don't cover up the Kings retired jerseys or the two Stanley Cup banners, and I think there's like a 92 Western Conference champion or something like that, but I was like, you know, I just realized that I didn't know anything about what was going on this season, so I just wanted to call you up, more or less have you inform me and our listeners who may or may not be, you know, hockey illiterate.
Well, perfect. That's the one sport I do know. So let's ask away.
Okay. Just before we get started, just for you listeners, if you did not catch when Joe was on last season, let's just get some backstory on you yourself. Like, where did you grow up personally?
Oh, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so hence I'm a Penguins fan, and hence it's been a very great last 2 years. They won the Stanley Cup the last 2 years, so things are fantastic for puck off land, except for all the people that listen, they hate the Penguins, and then they hear more Penguins than usual.
Well, okay, so I was looking, I was poking around online, I noticed Sidney Crosby, he's already... Like, Sid the Kid is now 30, so, I mean, he's no longer a kid, I don't think, anymore, officially, but, which is shocking, because I remember when he came in, I mean, was he 19, or still a teenager, or...
I'm sure he was 18 when he came in.
Yeah.
They get kids that talented as young as possible. They get them when they're 10, if they're good.
So, two things. One, why are NHL players able to play so long in some instances, like Jagr, or is that like an anomaly? But it seems like most players, if they want to, can play kind of deep into their 30s. And two, why is it more common that players stay with their teams? Like at this point, you know, he's been with Pittsburgh, 10, 11, 12 seasons. Now, why is that more common? Those two things I wanted to ask you.
Well, you know, not to deflate all your points, but I don't know if that's quite quite accurate.
Okay.
I guess I'll take, if I miss one point, then let me remind me. But just to get to the part of people moving around, I mean, Sid is definitely the anomaly.
Okay.
I mean, even Gretzky got traded a few times. You know, I mean, there's been a few. I mean, Ray Bourque chased the cup and left Boston, and he's immortal, you know. I mean, a few guys have stuck in the same place forever. I mean, very few. I mean,
okay.
Mario Lemieux, Steve Yzerman, Joe Sakic. I mean, a few knockdown Hall of Famers. I mean, even Patrick Waugh, the greatest goaltender I've ever seen. Even Martin Brodeur, the second greatest, got traded. So that point, I think, you know, I think, but sitting Gino, hopefully Gino too, but probably still stay the whole time. But you never know. As far as the age goes, you know, it's actually, at this point, I think is another one I have a little difference of opinion.
Yeah,
the league is getting younger and younger and younger. More kids are coming up and playing right away, and because it's much more based on speed than it ever used to be, than let's say toughness and guile. That, you know, there's been a lot of people have left this game earlier than maybe they would have 10 years ago because they can't clutch and grab and slash like they used to. So the young kids are getting more of a chance to play. And, you know, usually by like 34, 35, 36, almost in any sport, in any walk of life, you start slowing down. The guys that can stick are Jagr, because he's just ridiculous. He's always been Superman and had
so he is the anomaly. Yeah, because he's what, yeah, 44 and, or something, like 40,
44, 5, 45, I
just
believe.
Incredible.
Yeah, the things are what in hockey, when you can skate, you can all when you're a fast skater, you can stick around a little bit more. And also, most guys never lose their hands, you know, until the very end. That's why, like, Lemieux can make several comebacks, and he was always pretty much, you know, Lemieux. He's always had those sweet hands. That's why Yoggs can stick around, because he has those hands. He can make those plays with the puck. So if you can make plays with the puck, you can stick around a lot longer than just say a guy who is a grinder who's all about speed or toughness.
Okay,
you know, those guys seem to go faster.
It's
so the league faster. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, completely. Question? And in fact, and completely educated me too, because those opinions clearly were from someone watching just a couple names here and there and some Stanley Cup games at the end of every season. And that's about the extent of my hockey input. But when you do see Jagr, you know, re-signing a contract or you see his name and you're just, and you go back and check and you're thinking like, was it 92 his rookie season? You know, it's like, it's crazy to think how long that he's been playing. And so I guess that kind of sticks out more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, I was a kid. I wasn't a kid. I was, you know, like, you know, what I was, you know, 20. I was like 20. So I was still living in Pittsburgh. I didn't move out of Pittsburgh yet. I was watching him win Stanley Cups. You know, it's like I've had four lifetimes, and he's still playing hockey. You know, it's been crazy.
NHL 94 on Sega, and that's, you know, just dominating on that. Well, okay, so this season, what so far the first third of the season is been complete. What have been like kind of like the biggest surprises, you know, as far as teams go in your eyes?
Well, you know, if you want to get the grandiose picture, is the teams that you didn't expect to do well. You know, Vegas, first time in existence, an expansion team. They were given a better slot in life because they paid so much money for the team. But they got a few better players than most expansion teams get. But, you know, they have a great coach in Gerard Gallant, and then who was a very, very stupid move and not a good move by Florida. They got rid of him, but they've tanked ever since. But he's there, but they've been winning without even Flower, Marc-Andre Fleury, their number one goaltender. They got, like, their fourth goaltender. And they're still in the playoffs, so they're in the playoff picture right now. That's been amazing.
Yeah, in second place right now.
Yeah, the Kings, who I didn't think were going to make the playoffs, even though they're my mistress team. They got a new coach in John Stevens and Kopitar and Dustin Brown, and they're just playing lights out right now. They're playing amazing. The Winnipeg Jets, a team I've always loved, but it is chronically underachieved. With so much talent, you could not believe that they weren't. You couldn't believe their coach still had a job. They're on top of the Central Division, with maybe the most points in the league. I haven't checked the last couple of days, but they've played amazing. And so I'd have to say, as far as the good news in Vancouver, you know, the Sedins are playing less, and they're winning. And in Edmonton. You know, I'm sorry, in Winnipeg, the other Canadian city, Big Buff doesn't have a goal yet. And he's like, you know, he was always their best player for years, the guy everyone looked to. And then Tampa, who I picked to win the Stanley Cup, even though they didn't make the playoffs last year, they're crushing it in the East. Toronto's playing well in the East. As far as disappointments go, you know, you have to look at Edmonton. And McDavid, everyone thought that McDavid, they're crowning him McJesus, and he's going to be better than Sid this year. And they've really fallen off a cliff. I don't like their game at all. A few other things, but I'll keep it short, I guess. I'll try to.
No, it's all great. Because, I mean, that's as an outsider kind of to the NHL, that's another name you hear all the time, McDavid. He's, you know, 20-year-old goal scorer, I think, you know, one of the top young draws and what the NHL hopes to be the future face of the league. But is he legitimately like that good, or is it just a lot of hype, or somewhere in the middle?
Well, you know, very, very few people ever live up when hype is at that high of a level. How many people do? I mean, Sid has three cups. He has. LeBron has. I mean, Tiger Woods basically did. Right. Other than that, how many people live up to that kind of hype? I'm not a player hater. I love everybody unless they play for the Flyers. I think that his game has not evolved to the point where he's one of the best players in the league. He's not the best player in the league. And if you ask me if I'm picking a team who I'm taking first, I would take Austin Matthews, the number one pick the following year, who plays for Toronto. I like his game better. He goes more into the dirty areas. He plays more defense. He gets in spots. He's in different parts of the ice. McDavid's ice is played a lot on the rush, and it's played a lot on the outer levels, the outer reaches of the scoring areas. Whereas I think if he got his nose a little dirtier and worked on a few more aspects of his game, I think he'd be a much more rounded player. That being said, his teammates have let him down immensely. I don't know if his coach has done a great job. So his team has not played well, and he's still putting up points. So this is not a complete knock on Connor McDavid. I think his game needs to evolve more to be a top five player, other than just his extreme talent and speed, which completely shows up, and why he's amazing and you jump out of your seat when you watch him.
And but, he's only 20, and you're thinking, all right, he's got
yes, a, yeah. I think it's like five times a game. Does he make you jump out of your seat? Absolutely. Is he consistently the best player on the ice for his 20 shifts? Not enough for me.
Okay. I see it. Okay. But there are glimpses of, like, greatness, and you're like, okay, I can definitely see where. And that's the other thing with hockey.
Games of greatness, periods of greatness. He can dominate a game like very, very few people. But a lot of it, too, though, is that team. A lot of that team stands around and watches McDavid and waits for something good to happen with McDavid. And last year they played much better as a team. The team played much better last year. So it's all in the mix. And did he deserve the MVP last year? Absolutely. He was brilliant last year. He won the scoring race by like 20 points.
Wait, he was MVP last year?
Yeah, he beat out Sid, which, you know, is kind of ridiculous in a way, but he led the scoring. He won the scoring title by 14 goals, by 14 points.
Holy crap. I had no idea. See, I mean, this shows you how much.
He's a great player. I just don't think he's the best player in the world right now.
Okay, I see. You know? I got you. Okay. Yeah, when you're at the elite.
And I thought Drysdale had a better – I thought Drysdale, who also got a big contract and has also been a little disappointing this year. Well, he was injured, but still on the overall scheme, disappointing as the whole team has been. I thought Drysdale had a much better playoff than McDavid. But that's when the game gets closer, tighter, checked, a little more physical. I think Connor's only 20. I think he can gain a couple of years, put some hairs on his chest, and work his game a little more.
Add that old man 15 pounds here in a couple of years and be a little bit more physical.
Get his nose a little dirtier.
Gotcha.
Get in the scoring lanes. Make some things. There's ways. You know, I mean, anybody, you can see it on any great hockey player. I mean, Evgeny Malkin, Hall of Famer, three cups, scoring titles, MVPs. When he's floating around, he's not the same player as when he gets a burn in his saddle and starts driving to the net. You know, nobody is. Everyone's better when they're around the net in the slot. Everybody is. David included.
Yeah, you're picking up scraps. I mean, yeah, you're probably going home with a few more extra bruises and stuff like that. But
if you're going to the net, you're bringing people with you because everyone's watching you. Then everything opens up for other guys on your team as well.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, I guess from what you said in McDavid's case, if he did go, maybe that opens up makes it even easier for his teammates to actually contribute.
Right. But, you know, I mean, I don't think McDavid's lived up to par. I don't think he's played super well this year. But let me tell you, no one on that team has. And I am not going to sit here and tell you that McDavid is one of the problems on that hockey team.
Right.
His game is probably 15th on the list of problems with that team right now.
Okay.
So, you know.
Gotcha.
It's really it's nitpicking a great, great, great hockey player. So I'm just, you know, we're just talking.
Yeah, nitpicking, clearly. Okay, so on a personal level, before we get out of here, I just wanted to cover your hockey fandom. I mean, so the last when did Pittsburgh win their first cup? Was it 07? Or like recently?
No, they won in 91. They won in 1991, and they won in 1992. And that was with Mario Lemieux and Yager and Ronnie Francis and Kevin Stevens and Larry Murphy and Paul Coffey was on the first team. Rick Tocchet was on the second. The legendary Badger Bob coached team one and he died of cancer. Then Scotty Bowman, the even more legendary Scotty Bowman coached two. But I've been a fan since the Penguins were only blue in the 70s. My grandfather was a big fan.
I've been awesome. A fan. This generation.
Yeah, so it was a long time coming. And by the early 90s, we'd seen a lot of horrible hockey, but that's why Lemieux is Jesus to me because he came and saved everything.
Now the recent run. What was the more recent? Like when did that start? What was the first title then? I guess what I meant to ask.
2000. Sid and Gino's first was 2009.
2009.
And then it really looked like it was gonna never happen for those guys again until they fired Mike Johnson, and they hired Mike Sullivan. And the newer GM, Jim Rutherford, made a few shrewd moves, and the team got faster. And then the last 2 years, they've just been a juggernaut. Back to back, no one's done that since the late 90s, one back to back. So we're living a charmed life, Penguin fans, right now. We have to enjoy it because it's never going to come around.
I know, between you and Steve Byrne, it's awesome come playoff time over the years. But, well, okay, because I was going to say, you know, the Kings are your mistress team. So, I mean, how many Stanley Cups can one celebrate in a 10-year span?
I'm loving it. You know, I've been to four parades in like 6 years. Maybe 7 years.
That's now. How many were three of those in Pittsburgh, or how many of those were back in Pittsburgh?
The last two in Pittsburgh, and then the two Kings ones out here.
Okay,
fantastic.
Oh, it feels.
But me and Fraser, we started our show 5 years ago. And, you know, I mean, it's like, I like the Kings. I really just love hockey. So it seems like I just jumped on that bandwagon. But I was, you know, watching Kings games when they were terrible, too. So
the parade at home, like, it's just, I mean, just an incredible feeling. I went back to Kansas City for the Royals one. But just to be around, you just look around and you just see hundreds of thousands of people just having the time. It's like Mardi Gras for sports. It's just an incredible feeling. It's what it's all about. Like what you put in all the hours watching and talking about and complaining about, celebrating, and in some cases for decades without getting a championship. And then when it comes together, oh man, it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's what's so much fun is you can never recreate. Like I know Kansas City, the Royals. You know, you can never recreate like. When Lemieux won the first one, how it was just like such a shock and just the city just, you know, just the amazing. You can never, you always remember your first one. You know,
I hope I can say you know? That. I hope I can say that someday. Oh, I remember my first Royals World Series parade. That was great.
It's like they keep improving the parade every year for the Penguins.
At this point, you guys are professional parade route runners. You got like have streets named like this is Penguin Parade Route Street number one.
Yeah, the parade will follow the usual route.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Again, listeners, if you're in Southern California, go see Joe at the Irvine Improv December 29th. Also, you can find out more information at joebartnick.com, JoeBartnick. That's Joe, Joe, Bart, Nick. .com and then at Joe Bartnick, and then more importantly subscribe, listen to at Puck Off Podcast. I'm sure you guys get into much more detail. You can find that on Twitter online, but Joe, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate your time and your insight, and we'll have you back on in a month or two just to get us caught up again. Make me, you know, sound
anytime.
Thank you so much for. I know he's on the road a lot. He's always traveling. He's seeing games all the time, and I just appreciate the recap. Listeners, please listen to the Puck Off podcast. Find it on iTunes, and like we mentioned, go see Joe and Irvine. And like I mentioned, coming in, that was that song coming out. Hockey, great band from Portland. I don't even know if they're probably not together anymore, but. Their whole album's great, so check them out if you want to. But I don't know, it was weird because Southern California talking hockey. Earlier tonight, I went down with the wife, and they have in Manhattan Beach, they had Christmas in Southern California. Is so weird because there's no snow, and there's palm trees everywhere, and everyone's doing their best to get in the spirit, and they do a great job, and it was a big fireworks thing, and I was very skeptical and not necessarily in the best mood, and we actually got a sweet spot, and when I say sweet spot, it was probably 3/4 of a mile from the beach, and The city of Manhattan Beach did a great job. They they block off the pier and then load the entire thing up with fireworks and then block off, I don't know, about maybe 4 or 5 football fields worth of beach on either sand side of the pier, and had a band going. So the wife and I walked down by the water. It was awesome. It was like little kids Woodstock. I mean, just kids everywhere with glow sticks running around like they were like, I just imagine like that's what walking into a rave sober would look like if you were just like the most conservative person, like just sheltered, never like homeschooled kid, and you walked into a rave. Like that's what it felt like walking onto a beach with thousands of 6 to 12-year-olds just running around throwing glow sticks everywhere, just acting like they're just tripping balls, but they're really just kids having a great time. But it was great though. It was I had that weird like Hollywood Christmas moment where they're shooting off fireworks, the band's playing, there's like reflections coming off the Pacific Ocean. I just totally had to admit to my wife, I'm like, you nailed this one. This one is absolutely an amazing time. So, honey, thank you for that. And I guess what I'm saying is, guys, go out and do the thing. I know when I go back to Kansas City, gotta ride the trolley downtown. Not the trolley, the horse carriage. Gotta take the horse carriage. Around Crown Center. Like every town's got a little thing, and it's usually a pain in the ass. And this is not. This earlier tonight wasn't necessarily easy, but it was worth it, and I had a good time. So I just recommend just do the pain in the ass thing and just try to enjoy the holiday season. Is it too hard to do that? I mean, just reach out, just go outside of your comfort zone. Be like Rafael Palmeiro, go, you know, who recently has announced that he's going to make a comeback at 53, and whether that's with or without steroids, because I know it's been about 10 years since his very emphatic, I did not take steroids, pointing the finger at the Supreme Court judges or whatever judges they were, just lying through his teeth, because of course he later came out, he had all these, just failed so many drug tests, but anyway, Palmeiro's coming back, so that's awesome. So anyway, I'm rambling. You know who else is coming back right now after we get back from this break? Eric Marino, calling in from New York City. And of course, well, that's out. Yeah, you're right. That is Outkast that you are hearing right now, Quim and I. Very, very good ears you got there.
Okay. Even the sun goes down, heroes eventually die. Horoscopes often lie, and it's sometimes why. Nothing is for show, nothing is for certain. Nothing lasts forever, but until they close the curtain. It's him and I, a Quim and I.
All right, we are back, and Eric is back, calling in.
Hi, everybody. I missed you all. I know they do.
It's that soothing, relaxing voice full of knowledge. It sounds, you sound a little tired, I gotta be honest.
I'm just gonna say the city that never sleeps needs a nap. The city that never sleeps could really use a nap. And they're really like, look, I'll be real with you too. They sleep, bro. They go to bed. New York, this city sleeps. This sleeps, bro.
Does it sleep like from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m.? Is that really pretty much?
It's a very fitful, unclear sleep. Absolutely. It's like a little. It's like a meth or coke jitter sleep. Yes, absolutely.
Gosh, it's like taking. Is it Xanax that people would take right before they go to bed and wake up and turn into different people?
I guess, but, you know, different show, bro.
Kind of like one of those. Yeah. No. Well, good. I'm glad to get you back on. It's been, you know, look, if it can maintain every other episode, that's fucking, that's fine.
No, I would love it. Guys, I'm sorry that I've been here, but I'll tell you something, because here's something, Shoeser, I can start off right off the bat with, you know, because here I am in New York City, you know, and, you know, the essence of this show, Sportsaholics, is about the obsessions that we all have about sports. And I'll tell you that right now, here in New York City, they're going through a lot of things. They just brought Aaron Boone, who's the new Yankee manager, and they just fired Bob McAhoo from the Giants, and they benched Eli for a game just to break his streak, and now they're bringing him back. But one of the more interesting things was, like, I was, because I'm in New York, and I'm actually, like, able to read the New York Post, was, like, you know, some sports writer put, like, his 8-10-point plan of what the Giants need to do. And number two was hire Josh McDaniels of the New England Patriots. And even about how, like, because Belichick probably has a fond feeling for the Giants that he might let that happen. And that was very interesting. It was very interesting. It's very interesting to be in, say, an enemy market. And
not even enemy, but rival market.
Right. 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 You're saying, but it's also like, but you're, yes. And so you're reading the opposition's, you know, yeah, you're reading the opposition playbook, the opposition, what they want
to
do.
You're
right.
Going to Germany and reading about World War II from their perspective.
Right. I'm not, I never read the Kansas City Star's opinion of the Patriots. I don't read, you know, I just don't, for the most part, I don't have time for that.
You only pick up a Casey Star if it has to deal with Schlitterbahn, and we all know that.
Oh, Schlitterbahn, yeah, absolutely. There's developing news there, isn't it?
Now, do you feel threatened? Are you like, you can't take my coach, or is that the, is that
inevitable? No, I actually took it as a massive compliment, and it was just so interesting to see that, you know, like, it's interesting to see another team in disarray. And it's interesting to read, like, when you're in a town and the football, baseball, whatever team, like, their newspapers, their internet, their talk radio, and they are in a free fall. Like, I remember years ago, I remember being in Denver the year, it was like Jay Cutler was now in Chicago, and was it Marshall, Brandon Marshall?
Yeah,
the wide receiver. He was like a Miami Dolphin.
Yeah, and they just traded him to Miami.
Right, but the thing was, like, when you listen to, like, Bronco radio or, you know, football sports talk in the Denver area, it's like they were still talking about Jay Cutler, the Chicago Bear, and Brandon Marshall, the Miami Dolphin, sort of in that same way of like Boston when Ray Bourque went to the Colorado Avalanche. It's like, hey, we can't do anything, so hopefully these good players will go and be better on better franchises.
They were that, but see,
I'm telling you, I'm reporting a real thing.
That's crazy.
There was a point where, like, right before Tebow Mania,
they were that desperate, huh?
They were literally just like when they talked Bronco football, they were really talking Chicago Bear, Miami Dolphin football.
I mean, yeah, because Ray Bourque played for the Bruins for 20 years, you know, and then I'm
making an analogy. Right. Like, okay, it was just sort of close to that.
Okay, like, it's gotcha. Like a similar passion. Like you're
just, right. You're saying it's like, hey, we have like, but you're also saying it's like, hey, you guys love, hey, Bronco fans, you love football so much. Let's tell you about where good football is being played, Chicago and Miami.
I'll give them that.
Which, by the way, that's how bad it was in Denver that they thought Chicago and Miami were where the good football was at the time.
God, just like any Broncos team, just wait 5 years and you'll be in another Super Bowl.
Maybe, you know, I don't know. It's like I thought the Brock Osweiler thing was going to work out a little bit better than it did. But I think that too much time passed and somehow they have spoiled fruit.
And he just, you know, he just never was quite, they always thought he was going to be better than he was. Because I remember Brock Osweiler from high school because I was going up to Montana. He's from Kalispell,
sure,
north of Missoula. And, like, I remember reading about him when he was in high school and that he was going to go to Arizona State. And then, you know, he did good things there. But just to carry a franchise, you have to be a certain elite level of quarterback that we have established Brock Osweiler is not after four tries.
No, it's like that's one of those things where I have to say I'm going to disagree with the common wisdom on Brock Osweiler. In my opinion, he could have won that Super Bowl. He could have won Super Bowl 50, but they basically benched him for Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning had the worst starting quarterback, like for a winning quarterback of a Super Bowl, Peyton Manning's numbers were the worst. I think Brock Osweiler knew that basically it was almost like being Jeff Hostetler for the Giants.
With the Sims?
Right. It's like, you know, it's like Osweiler knew that was really his Super Bowl. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a certain point. Yeah. Like, I put it to you this way. What if Drew Bledsoe had started that Super Bowl instead of Tom Brady? Maybe, like, or here's another one. What if Alex Smith, I think Alex Smith wins for San Francisco over Colin Kaepernick. Like, I think the Alexander Smith 49ers might not have gotten down as severely to the Baltimore Ravens.
Well, I mean, everyone in Kansas City knows that Alex can manage a game. He'll get you a quick three downs and a punt, but they'll run the ball and, you know, keep that clock running. So
no, Alex Smith, by the way, future generations will always speak of Alex Smith as underrated. And I think you guys, and especially all our Kansas City fans, and I know we have a lot of them, be kinder to Alex Smith, because remember, it's like Matt Leinart should have come out that year and should have been the number one draft pick to the San Francisco 49ers. And in a weird way, Alex Smith got too much spotlight being the number one draft pick for the 49ers.
Coming out of Utah, came out of nowhere.
Right. It's like, no, dude, it's like how Roethlisberger came out of Miami, Ohio, but then went to the Steelers and they had Jerome Bettis. Like, they weren't expecting, like, they didn't need Roethlisberger to lead the team. Like, the first Super Bowl Roethlisberger won was, like, you know, it was more running team.
Yeah, no, that whole Super Bowl was get the bus back to Detroit, his home city, and win him a Super Bowl.
But it's also, like, it's one of those things, like, look, there's a difference now. Like, the Russell Wilson Seahawks are different than the Super Bowl champion Seahawks that won 4 years ago, if you know what I'm saying. You know, there's a, like, we did a mix of run and pass that we don't do now. At a certain point, teams have to make decisions. We put our resources into a Vince Wilfork or a Tom Brady. We put them into Peyton Manning, Russell Wilson.
Yeah, but, you know, the game evolves and coaches get wise. I mean, that's what the Chiefs start out hot, you know, whatever, 6-0, and then people figure out how to stop their offense.
No, I do always feel that Kansas City is the tale of two. It's like Kansas City refuses to acknowledge that it is a McDLT, hot side hot, cold side cold. It's a cold winter city and a hot city all at the same time. Like, in the summer, it's Miami. Or Houston.
Yeah. It's humid.
Sometime in November, December, it's as cold as Buffalo or Green Bay. And somehow you guys are always, you know, you start 7-1 and end up, you know, 8-8.
Yeah. Yeah,
you'll put it together on the back half.
That's the thing. Like, I can't even complain. I mean, there was one year that I think four teams had to lose, all lost, and the Chiefs backed into the playoffs. You know,
yeah. I mean, that's the thing. But that's the weird thing. Like, no one acknowledges. It's like, look, there are certain things that nobody acknowledges in sports. Like, hey, throwing a football as the starting quarterback of the Chicago Bears on the literal edge of a Great Lake is probably a terrible idea. The reason there's the Chicago Bears have no history of quarterbacks, none. Like, there's Jim McMahon, there's Sid Luckman, there's Jay Cutler, there's nobody.
Yeah.
Like, they're not a quarterback. Like, but do they have Mike Singletary? Do they have Earl Locker? You know what I mean? Do they have a history of Butkus, just being the monsters? Right. Yeah. Butkus, the monsters of the Midway. It's like, yeah. Because guess what? It's easy to be a middle linebacker on the shore of a Great Lake. What it isn't easy to do is being a forward pass throwing quarterback.
You're right.
On the edge.
Which is exactly why last week's episode 154 was the Brian Urlacher, number 54 episode. And so,
And what I'm saying is the one of those secret things about the NFL is the Kansas City Chiefs are the, to me, the Chiefs are, you guys are like the ultimate Jekyll and Hyde first half, second half team. You have no idea what's going to happen in the first eight games versus this. They're, you guys are two different teams.
Yeah, it's always an injury. Like, the just yeah, it's no. I'd agree with that. Now, let's switch it up to baseball because I like Aaron Boone, and I'm scared because I love his interview so far. He's just happy. He's like, it's like they just gave, it's like Little Big League or whatever the movie where he buys the Twins. Like, that's what I feel yep. like Aaron Boone is right now. Because I remember months ago they would ask him, like, as he's working, would you ever consider managing? You know, maybe, I don't know, you know, and just kind of sure. being coy with it. But then as it got closer and his name started getting thrown out, but and then when they announced it, I love the hire, and I think it's I mean, nothing wrong with Girardi. It and this era now, you know, now that I'm in my 30s and all the players are now becoming managers, you know, Matheny and St. Sure. Louis and Roberts and in LA and
sure.
But
I mean, Dave Roberts' face is not even the same face of the guy that stole that base in 2004. Oh, it's crazy. It's he looks different.
Right. It's one of those, definitely one of those Obama 08 pictures versus Obama.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you know what Tommy Lasorda looks like, but you don't actually know what Tommy Lasorda looks like when he ever was like in playing shape. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, right. Mm-hmm. Which I believe he actually played in Kansas City. I don't know if it was for the A's or the Blues.
Yeah, that's probably very true. But that's those weird things. Like, you know what Earl Weaver, you know what they look like as managers, but not as players anymore.
But I think I think it's a great hire for the Yankees, and it's gonna make it even tougher to root against them now. But that's fine. I can muster up the strength to do it, I feel like.
Here's what I enjoy it because to me it's like Joe Torre was one of the few managers that as Red Sox fans, like, there were moments, especially before 04, that Joe Torre and how he did the Yankees in 98 and 2000, it's like before we won in 2004, we were like, oh, you know, hey, Yankees, you let go of Joe Torre. Because they had that whole, like, it's New York, it's Steinbrenner.
Yeah, and that was right at the tail end of...
Right,
of...
it's like, and it's like, there was a point where, like, Red Sox Nation was very ready to be like, hey, Yankees, you drop Joe Torre, we're going to pick that shit up. And, I mean, it's like, and I'll actually, you know, it's like, this is a very rare thing for me to do. I'll really give Joe Girardi... a real sportsaholic tip of the cap, you know, Hall of Fame kind of thing. Because, you know, he has a world championship. It's not an easy market. He came right as a player. Like, he's a former player. He is a key player of the core four, whatever that kind of shit.
Right, right.
With the Jose. Jeter. He's not a core four because that's Posada. But you know what I'm saying? Like, he's part of those teams. He's recognizable. It's a really tough market. And it's like, look how easy it is to be the Mets. Like, you know, it's like they win even rebuilding years. In some senses, like, it would be really easy to me to hate on Aaron Boone because of the 0-3 home run against Wakefield. But in some ways, like, I celebrate it because it's like, hey, man, as far as I'm concerned, the Yankees were gelling into something very dangerous. And I'm all about them suddenly getting a new manager and not knowing and maybe having trouble adjusting to it. Like, I'm all about that.
Just whatever's going to mix it up and not keep it the same winning. All that he actually had ended up in the top five winningest Yankee managers of all time just because he had been there.
I mean, there's also a point, like, remember, it's like in, you know, it's like I'm always going to say the 09, if there was a series in our lifetime that was fixed, it's like the Yankees were going nowhere in 09. And they just opened that new stadium, the new, you know, the house that Ruth did not build.
Correct.
And suddenly they had a losing record, and it was June, and they weren't selling out. It was like the Yankees literally needed to win the World Series that year just for debt service to pay the bills on the new stadium. Like, I mean, if I was going to say the MLB fixed one World Series, it would have been that one.
Was that the Rockies? They swept the Rockies?
No, we swept the Rockies in 07. That would have been 09. I don't remember. The Yankees were against...
I'm just going to look it up.
Yeah, I don't remember. Because it doesn't matter.
No, well, you know, it's always good to... was the Phillies.
Yeah, that's but the right. Phillies had just... But the Phillies had won the year or before. Two before.
Yep, that's right, that's right. But, no, I don't know. Like, the league's healthier with the Yankees. I mean, the Yankees are already...
You can say that. But you know what? I mean, there's another argument. Here's the other argument. It's like, do you need the 49ers to be healthy? Do you need the Dallas Cowboys to be healthy? Because the end is, you don't. It's like, there's a certain point where it's like, I don't need the Lakers and the Celtics to be healthy if the Warriors and the Cavaliers are.
Right,
it's like,
right.
If the Heat in San Antonio or Detroit in San Antonio are hot, I don't need the – it's like, you know, in the sense of like, hey, another one will always rise up. Like, that's what we want to just – you know, it should move around.
Well, it's just the Yankees right now, they're just incredibly young. And then, you know, with Gary Sanchez and then, you know
– Aaron Judge is amazing. You know, you have a new, like, you have a guy – you're saying you have a rookie that literally out-hit Mark McGwire. As a rookie.
And here's the other thing it's going to do. Now you have a guy that, I mean, he's LeBron James's size. He's an inch shorter. He's 6'7". And I think he weighs 250. I think LeBron, or 265. Because Stanton is 6'6", 250. And Judge is 6'7", like 265. He's just a little bit bigger than Stanton. I mean, he could be a tight end. And so I'm... assuming this is going to inspire a new generation of baseball players too, like the big oversized giant guy is going to pick up a bat now.
Oh, that's a good idea. I mean, you know, in some ways that's good for the game.
Yeah,
sure.
No, it's, you know, it, like, that's why baseball.
Well, because I mean, let's also be honest. Let's also say that we may have literally seen the end of football this past weekend.
Yeah, no, it. I mean, it's a modern day. Was it David?
We haven't even. We're not even talking about whether Shishir can walk or not, or he'll ever walk again, or has feeling in his legs.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it's definitely could be a nail in the NFL coffin, you know.
No, and you had so it's like you had, and also so we've had a Gronkowski get suspended, a guy gets put in the guy that he hit cheaply was put in the concussion protocol. We had Perfect knocked out of a game. We had Shishir knocked out of a game. It's like, and I'll put it to you this way, you know, like one of those stupid things that I do is, and you can think whatever you want, but I happen to check out the Huffington Post. It's like a sort of a news political gathering site. And I remember Tuesday morning, the headline on the Huffington Post was Hell NFL Game. Like, that's how bad the Cincinnati Pittsburgh game was so tough and terrible, and those penalties were so bad that it got national attention. That the whole country had to talk about how brutal football was.
I mean, it's brutal. You could argue that that's old school football. I mean, that's a long time rivalry.
Old school, by the way. It's like, but well, so what else have we realized in 2017 that old school is over?
Yeah, no, most definitely is
like whatever's old school. Like, and I really, guys, everyone knows what's going on in 2017. Old school is over.
Yeah, that's a good blanket statement. But it was entertaining. I mean, God, I sound horrible. I don't want to see anyone get paralyzed. That was
no.
Just...
By the way, it's like no, but it's like, you know what, Michael Wilbon on Pardon the Interruption. Was saying like, hey, isn't that the football that I fell in love with? He had like sort of almost like guilty pleasure, realizing like this is now the rare game. It's like this is actually the violent game he fell in love with during the 70s and 80s.
Well, I know the main difference was that back then, you know, you didn't realize that people were going to be getting massive concussions, you know, that this was going to be causing long-term.
No, you did though. But it's like, look, Darryl Stingley was, I mean, not the Patriots, Darryl Stingley. We had Mike Utley. We had...
Bird
Utley,
for the Jets.
Dennis Bird Dennis from the Bird, Jets. Yeah. Utley was from the Lions. It's like that's like when you're just whistling past a graveyard. You knew. It was like we all lived, you and I lived through the ESPN jacked up phase. You know, they replaced it with Come On Man, but, you know, it's like jacked up, like, you know, it's like there would be jacked up Instagram, like, in another America.
Yeah, that was a show, right, that the NFL produced?
Jacked up. Like, that would be part of their, you know, Monday night ESPN. What they did now is Come On Man.
Right.
But it was like brutal hits, guys over the middle. I mean, isn't that also the fact that you're saying that, like, after the rule change of, what, 2003, 2004, it's like the Patriots were the guys like, you know, can an Edelman, could a Wes Welker even exist? Could you have a small possession receiver the size of an Edelman, Amendola, or Welker?
Or the, like, Cody Kupp or whatever the Rams
were. I'm just saying, but they went over the middle. Yeah, but, like, this in 98, do you have that? You could have that in 2007. From 2007 to 2017, the last 10 years, you can have these small possession going over the middle receivers. But you did not have that. You didn't, you know what I mean? Like, Todd Christensen is a different, Ben Coates is a different thing. Like, you did not have these, they're more or less like scat backs. Like, you did not have these small possession receivers running over the middle like they do now.
Yeah, just taking beat. Yeah, no, you're right. And that's, I mean, if you ever get a chance, they'll usually replay the, I think it's the 2003 national championship game, the Ohio State Miami, and mm-hmm. or 2002. But
sure.
I've watched it a couple years in a row just because it's a great game, and there's like 25 NFL players that are playing in the game too, which is kind of cool. But there's so many times you'll watch a play and just be like, where's the flag? Like, that's a late hit. And then you're like, oh, wait, that's 2002. They didn't call it back then. It's a It's almost like watching an entire different game. And so now we've got teenagers that have grown up kind of on the new football. And so they didn't.
Well, I'll even say this. Like, by the way, as horrendous as the, and I'm going to say this, I will not defend Gronkowski on coming back and hitting that guy.
And by the way, that concussion that's not from that hit. There's no way.
I'm not even gonna get involved in that discussion. But what I will say is, under the current rules, when you saw everything that happened before the interception, it's like, oh, there are flags all over. Like the fact that it wasn't flagged is ridiculous. It is ridiculous. Because he was all up in him and he was all over him. And, you know, that's how the interception happened. It's like, yeah, so there was, I mean, you know, Gronkowski's completely wrong, but.
I just loved it because he did that little stutter step. It reminded me of, like, a giant little kid getting ready to, like, jump on his
I'm going to get him.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, what's he doing?
he was bad.
Like, he thought about not doing it and then was like, nah, I'm going to do it.
Okay. Yeah. And then it was very strange, like, you know, one of the suspensions from the Steelers Bengals games was upheld and one was not. And it's a little dubious over there, but, you know, that's where we're getting. It's a very strange, we're in a transitional paradigm shifting time.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know.
You know, it's like, you can't, like, you know, like, we're all, we can't blow through the catcher anymore. We live in a different era. That's not how plays at the plate are made.
Yeah.
Hand check rules in basketball.
Second base, like, second base now.
Right, like the Utley rule.
The like, Utley, you know I mean? The Buster like, Posey, it, and the Chase Utley rule.
Exactly. There are these different, this is the way we play sports now.
Now they're talking about adding a second first base, softball style, like where there's two first bases, one on each side of the line, that way to avoid collisions at first base.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, put a shamrock of bases there. I could give a shit. You could literally put four bases there and I'd be fine.
Like, that's cool.
I mean, like, seriously, why? It's like, I swear to God, why don't we just do that? Just actually take the bag that is and just add a bag on each one of the sides, north, south, east, and west, so the first baseman can be almost a foot closer to whoever.
Just people.
And you're a foot closer. By the way, the runner is also, by the way, it's fair because the the runner is a foot closer. Like, there is a bag closer. You know, you're one bag closer to home plate.
Just creating massive collisions when people diving
it's,
back.
It's actually it would avoid collisions. You're just like, I have no problem. That's like, you know, there's very funny, you know, people who work on golf courses trying to get more business for their golf courses have experimented with gigantic, larger holes to make it more
family friendly. Yeah, no, I've seen that. Yeah.
Amateur friendly.
Yes.
You know, it's almost making it like the, it's making golf like the, hey, we're going to put inflatable tubes in the gutters for kids. Like, we're going to make this as easy as possible.
The problem is, it's like that does nothing when you're shanking your 7-iron 200 yards away from the green.
Absolutely. But what I'm saying is, in the world of, like, you know, make first base as big as you want. Gotcha. I don't care.
Now, are you going to go to any Mets or Yankees games in the spring?
I think that's going to happen. I was actually like, I did actually, I mean, you get like
10 Red Sox games or something. I mean, or probably at least 5 or 6 before the summer starts.
We'll see. I mean, it's a real tough thing. That's a real tough thing. The greatest thing about living in New York is realizing that if you just lightly scratch a Yankee fan, there's a very sad Nick Ranger Jet Giant fan underneath. They're not very happy. They're not as happy as you think they are.
You know what? You're absolutely right. I mean,
Yankee fans are actually, like, Yankee fans are overcompensating. It's also the fact that, like, you know, here's something I want guys, everyone, especially everyone who's like under 46. Okay, I really want you to hear me. If you're under my age, 46, think of this. Most of the Yankee championships, the legendary 27, didn't actually happen in our lifetime. Like, most of them didn't. Like, there's a good number that did. I mean, you know, there's the Reggie Jackson, and there's the four with Jeter. Like, I'm not saying, and, you know, they got the other one with Jeter and A-Rod. But
so I
there's
mean,
also a lot. Starting, not, it's like what I'm saying is, like, they didn't live. They didn't win 27 in your lifetime.
They've won 7 since 1977. They've won 7.
That's what we're saying. Yes. It's like, and that's a lot. But, like, the Red Sox, Dodgers,
there's a
20, Cardinals.
There's an 18-year gap between 78 and, you know, and 96.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is the greatest thing is that they literally didn't win. They never won while Don Mattingly was a Yankee.
That's the thing. The Yankees were horrible. When I was a kid, it was Mattingly was the Yankees, and they were never good. But Mattingly was such a star, you just assume that they were as a tiny kid.
No, that's one of the greatest things is when you meet a Yankee fan whose favorite player is Don Mattingly. That's like one of the greatest things, and there are a whole bunch of them because it was a generational thing.
Yeah, and he never. I don't. Well,
no, it's rooting for the Wade Boggs Red Sox. It's the same thing.
It's the same.
I mean, realize,
they're the same player.
This,
in fact,
if you're really a Don Mattingly fan, the fact that Wade Boggs won as a Yankee and Don Mattingly didn't is like insanity. Like, if you're a Don Mattingly fan, that should drive you insane.
What year was Wade Boggs on the 96? Did he squeeze in 96?
I don't know. It's 96, 98. Yeah, it's one of those. He rode the horse. It's one of the early ones.
That's, you know, I mean, I swear, like, whenever I would pull, like, I would pull a Don Mattingly out of a pack of cards and run into my brother's room and be like, hey, I got a Wade Boggs. And he'd be like, that's Don Mattingly. Oh, yeah, that's right. They're two.
It's
different.
All the same.
Yeah.
They're totally the same.
I'm like, they were absolutely the same player. But you've been to Shea Stadium, but City Bank or whatever the hell the new.
You mean MetLife? I had to drive past the Jets game recently when I came back into town after Thanksgiving. After that terrible showing. It's fun. You know, it's like, I want to get out there. I definitely want to go see some Jet games. I want to, you know, it's like, we'll get there. We'll slowly go to Madison Square Garden and the, in the Barclays Center. We'll get there.
Well, if I come out in March, maybe we can go to try to get to a Knicks game or something like that. Hockey, I mean, hockey's actually really cool. And I mean, that's why. You know,
we got, literally, nice.
Pun intended, but I just don't know anything about it. And, you know, that's why I try to educate myself. But there's a bunch of good young players. I do know that. But I don't know where the Rangers or the Islanders are right now. I'm just going to guess they're the 7 and 8 seed just to play it safe.
All right, Caesar. Well, I know you have a lot more show to go, but I'm glad you guys, I'm glad we all stopped by and get to visit.
No, again, I like that. Every other week, if that works, that's fucking awesome. But
hey, guys, stay obsessed out there. Sportsaholics, stay obsessed. This is Eric Marino reporting from live from New York.
Get some sleep. We'll talk soon, all right?
See you later.
Good, like every other episode, like I said, that's I'm fine with that. Thanks for it's good to have you on here. Now stay busy, stay funny, stay 17% funnier or better out there. Okay, so earlier I talked about just addictions to anomalies. I mentioned it back way probably like 45 minutes ago, but I like differences, like weird things that happen. And so I love like baseball history, like just right around my little office here. I've got this Eddie Goodell. If you don't know who Eddie Goodell is, well, it's one of my Christmas presents. I got a little Eddie Goodell. Look, yeah, it's not Christmas yet, but guess what? I don't have kids and my wife and I are going to be traveling for all around Christmas, so we're adults, so we get to open our presents whenever the hell we want to. And guess what? That was on the 11th and 12th this year is when we decided to open some of our presents. So I got an Eddie Goodell bobblehead, and he was the midget for the St. Louis Browns at 1951, August 18th, took four pitches and took first base against Bob Kane and the Detroit Tigers. Like, I got a little, this weird Bob Kane autographed, I don't know, it's like a postcard or something, but got my KC Monarchs, House of David, 1934, little ticket stub that somewhere around here. I've got the April 29th, 2015, Baltimore Orioles, White Sox game, played in Baltimore. All the fans shut out. The only game in baseball history where no fans were in attendance. Got the ticket stuff. Like, I like that kind of stuff. And so just rummaging around eBay, of all places, I came across this random guy, Floyd Spear. And there was, from what I could gather, it was in the early 60s, there was a baseball historian that was reaching out to all the former players and would mail out these little questionnaires and just with questions, like they were all personalized. They say, you know, do you have three kids or two, or how much did you pitch in 57 and 58 in Boston and then go to Baltimore? Just kind of these little detailed hand notes, and you could, these things were up for auction. And so I started looking at one. This guy named Floyd Spear, and he pitched in three games, had a 9 ERA, had two strikeouts, total of two innings. And his career was from April 25th, 43 to May 3rd, 44. So barely over a year. And this guy was from Boonville, Arkansas, played in the Pacific Coast League, I think for the Oakland Oaks for a little while, but didn't even start, played down what they called the Cotton League at the time, in the 30s. Didn't start till he was 25. Just a weird dude, but just from Boonville, Arkansas, as to why he didn't start still late. But it was during the wartime, and so that was, they needed players. That's the only reason I could think. But it was just that weird kind of Field of Dreams, you know, Doc. You know, just you never got your chance. But I mean, he did. He got two games. But it was fascinating because then I go through and you're looking at this paper, and this is where I get weird. I don't give a shit. But it's got his address, so you can go there. Like, so I Google MapQuest, like the guy's the address. Like this, so then now you're looking at the house that this dude lived in up until he died in 1969. I'm assuming, Like, that's how nerdy I get. And then I find a website. Some guys out nerded me and actually gone around taking a picture of Floyd Spears' gravesite in Arkansas. And then I'm like, God damn. Then I get jealous. I'm like, dude, this guy's got his shit together. He's got a baseball history website gravestone going. I mean, it doesn't look that great, but still a lot of information there. And then, so I'm on the Floyd Spear, like, oh, great. And I'll bug my wife with this crap. And she listens and nods, and that's cool. And that's why I love her. Then I stumble across The Glory of Their Times. And this was a book published in 1966, written by Lawrence Ritter. And the whole book was inspired by Ty Cobb's death. And Ritter realizes that, oh man, like all these great players from, you know, the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century are all quickly going to be passing away. And so starting in 61, he spent just 4 or 5 years. I know he traveled over 75,000 miles just gathering interviews, just hours and hours of audio. And then through all these interviews, he talks to Fred Snodgrass, who played with the Giants, New York Giants, before, which are now the San Francisco Giants, from 1908 to 1916. But his most kind of infamous, like, if baseball historians, this sort, all this kind of stuff, if you say Fred Snodgrass, 1912, he dropped a pop fly in the World Series that in the 10th inning ends up costing him the game. And even though he makes this miraculous catch, apparently the very next at bat didn't matter. You know, they always remember the bad stuff. And so this guy, Fred Snodgrass, he starts talking, you know, to Lawrence Ritter and doing his research for this book, The Glory of Their Times. And he brings up this Charles Victory Faust, who was this farm kid from Marion, Kansas, and didn't play baseball, but somehow ends up on the Giants. And so this book, which I have not read, I have watched the movie. So he made a documentary, and it, oddly enough, and so if the book came out in 66, I'm assuming the documentary 67, somewhere close, you know, to 66. It's Ken Burns of baseball. It's definitely, you watch this and you're just like, oh, okay. So that's where Ken Burns got that from. And it's like inning number two from Ken Burns baseball, if it was very, you know, in that kind of tone, that same era. Like, it starts off with Kristen Mathewson. And anyway, so here's a clip from The Glory of Their Times. You can find this on YouTube. This is talking about this weird Charles Victory Faust. Now, this is the firsthand account from Fred Snodgrass, who played on the Giants.
The most superstitious of all was John McGraw. When his team defeated the Philadelphia A's in the World Series of 1905, they wore black uniforms. In 1911, they would again meet the A's, and manager McGraw, for good luck, ordered the same black uniforms to be worn. McGraw also had another ace in the hole to whammy the Athletics. Fred Snodgrass tells about the good luck charm.
We were having batting practice. Out of the grandstand walks an individual, tall, lanky, in a dark suit. He said, I'd like to talk to Mr. McGraw. Mr. McGraw, he says, my name is Charles Victory Faust. And a few weeks ago, I went to a fortune teller who told me that if I would join the New York Giants and pitch for them, that they would win the pennant. Well, Mr. McGraw looked at him, and being superstitious as most ball players were, he said, well, take off your coat. And he said, here's a glove and a ball, and I'll get a catcher's mitt and I'll warm you up. And McGraw would give one signal and Charlie would wind up, and his wind up was like a windmill. Well, every different sign that McGraw gave, the ball came up just the same. And there was no speed, and so McGraw finally threw the glove away and he caught it barehanded. And McGraw said, well, he said, we're taking Charlie along to help us win the pennant. Every day from that day on, Charles Victor Faust was in uniform, and he warmed up every day this happened. And we did win the pennant. The spring came around the next year, and Charles Victor Faust was in the training camp. He warmed up every day in 1912, and again, we won the pennant in 1913. He was again in the spring training camp. He warmed up every day to pitch. And during that season, he became such a drawing card with the fans. They clamored so hard and so loudly for McGraw to put him into pitch that McGraw did put him into pitch. And he pitched one full inning. And he didn't have enough to hit. They didn't score on him. He was gone 4 days, and we lost 4 ball games. The fifth day, Charlie showed up. Oh, he said, fellas, I got to pitch today. He says, you fellas need me. So he got out and warmed up with this windmill warm-up that he had, and we won. And we won the pennant again. That fall, he said, I'm not very well, but he said, I think if you would prevail on Mr. McGraw to send me to Hot Springs a month before spring training, that I could get into shape and help you win another pennant. But unfortunately, that never came to pass because Charlie Faust died that winter and we did not win the pennant the next year.
See, and that's where the story takes an interesting twist. And again, that is from The Glory of Their Times. If you want to, you can just go to YouTube right now and watch the documentary. It's about an hour. It's very in-depth, very baseball nerdy. I loved it. And that's kind of where I stumbled across Charlie Faust. And so, as Fred Snodgrass just mentioned, he didn't come back to camp because he got sick and, you know, passed away. So, as I did earlier with Mr. Floyd Spear, who did play for the Brewers for 3 games in 1943, and, you know, nerded out with Faust. So come to find out, there's a whole episode of what was actually an awesome, really, it's a great history podcast called Memory Palace. And so he was actually one of their entire episodes from 2015. I think it's episode, it's either 78 or 87, one of those two. Anyway, so I'm just going to pull it. Here it is. It's a great little story. It kind of sums up this guy's whole life. And it's just one of those great things with baseball. Like this guy, we'll talk about it after you get back. This is Memory Palace.
Of land, got married, had 4 kids, expected them to work the farm and take it over one day. That is why you leave Germany in 1880-something and come all the way to Kansas. That's the point. But something was off with Charlie Victor Faust. Something was atypical, as we might say now, with the way his brain worked. History hasn't left us enough clues to sort out quite what. We're just left to try and translate, to take some of the language that people used to talk about him then. Slow, idiot, crazy, simple, and try to find a name, a diagnosis, that matches up with our current understanding of the brain and behavior, and try to pin it down before that understanding changes, and we wind up wondering just what we were thinking about what he was thinking. But there was something different about Charlie, always was, and it meant that he was not cut out to run his father's farm. And he probably knew it, probably was aware in his way that his father knew it. But he stayed on the farm, never liking the farm. And so he must have been happy for the day off when the tents went up at the fairground in Wichita in 1911. And it must have been something for this 30-year-old man to leave his little town and head to the big city, such as it was, ride some rides, walk the midway under the string lights in a summer night. There was a fortune teller there. I don't know if it was a man or a woman. I don't know if he or she read tarot cards or chicken bones or tea leaves or gazed into a crystal ball. I don't know anything about this particular fortune teller. But I know a thing or two about fortune tellers. The game is that they are less reading your cards or your palm than they are reading you. The game is they take things that they know about human nature and things they glean about you, about their customer, wide-eyed and searching or skeptical and smirking, and then concoct a vague story guaranteed to resonate specifically. The cards say you have a secret. They say you've lost something, something very valuable to you. They sense there's someone whose approval you seek, but you're afraid you're somehow not good enough for them. And then they make predictions that will hold up upon reflection, whatever the outcome. That's the game. That's how it's supposed to work. On the morning of Thursday, July 21st, 1911, John McGraw was watching his players warm up at Robinson Field in St. Louis. He was the manager of the New York Giants, who started that day 3.5 games out of first place in baseball's National League. And McGraw was sitting on the bench, or hitting ground balls, or pondering his lineup card, and a man in a cheap suit walked up and introduced himself as Charlie Faust. He spoke in an odd accent, a little German and a little hick. He said he'd come all the way from Kansas, about 450 miles, because he had been to a fortune teller. And that fortune teller didn't tell him his lucky numbers, or to beware of a mysterious stranger. He told him that he, Charles Victor Faust of Marion, Kansas, would pitch the New York Giants to the World Series. Now, John McGraw was a superstitious man. He always kept an eye out for a lucky penny. He changed the color of the team's uniforms to break a losing streak. And so when this farmer showed up, decent-looking kid, 6'2", pretty fit, if a little strange, with a story like that, so specific, and so, let's face it, desirable from the perspective of the New York Giants baseball club, he figured he'd see what the kid could do. So McGraw grabs a catcher's mitt and tells Charlie he's going to run through some signs. One finger for the fastball, two for the curve, basic stuff. He'll put down the sign, and Charlie will show him what he's got. So Charlie takes the mound, toes the rubber with his Sunday shoes, checks the sign, and leans back into his windup. Starts whipping his arm around and around like some thrill ride at that state fair, and fires the ball to the startled McGraw. Who could have boiled a pot of water during the time he waited for the pitch to cross the plate? McGraw signals for the heat, and the curve, and the screwball, and each one comes in just the same. Pretty straight, super slow, and imminently crushable. And between the absurd windmill windup, and the fact that this kraut rube hasn't seemed to notice that his tryout is going terribly, the manager realizes that the kid is slow, or nutty, or a few bricks shy, or however it was that people like John McGraw understood people like Charlie Faust in 1911. And so he decides to have some fun with him, as the euphemism goes, and he tells his guys to take the field. And someone hands Charlie a bat. Folks in the stands, there early to watch batting practice, get a show as this lanky 30-year-old guy steps up to the plate in a suit and swings and misses a few times at the balls that McGraw is lobbing in until he tops a little nubber that rolls to the shortstop, who's in on the bit at this point, and bobbles it and lets Charlie take first, and then laughs as Charlie keeps going, singularly focused on trying to stretch his improbable infield single to an impossible double, and then keeps going as the delighted Giants just happen to miss the tag at second, and then happen to throw the ball away, and Charlie makes the turn at third and dives into home as the crowd goes wild. And he pops up, not bothering to brush the dirt off his suit, maybe unaware that it's there, and asks if he's starting that night. Charlie Faust sits on the end of the bench that afternoon in a too small uniform, comically small, intentionally comically small, as the Giants play the Cardinals. He doesn't pitch, of course he doesn't pitch, but the Giants win. And the superstitious McGraw invites him back the next day, when they win again. And the next day, when they win again. So the players are feeling great, and they've taken 3 out of 4 from St. Louis. They're like a half game out of first place. And they slap Charlie in the back and maybe buy him a beer or two. And they thank him for bringing them a little bit of luck. Then they hop the train out of town. They lose 4 out of the next 6 games in the road trip. And when they stagger back home and show up at the stadium to play Philadelphia and try to turn things around, there is Charlie Faust. He'd hop freight trains. It took him a week, but he'd made it to New York City. Saw Manhattan for the first time flickering through the slats of some boxcar. John McGraw was stunned, and he knew 3 things. A, this hayseed was going to be hard to shake. B, the team had been losing since they left him behind in St. Louis. And C, if you see a lucky penny, you pick it up. Charlie got a uniform and a spot on the bench, and they started winning. The papers loved the story of Charlie Victor Faust. They started calling him Victory Faust as the Giants charged up the standings. Fans would come early to watch him chase down fly balls during batting practice, would delight in how bad he was at it, how sometimes the balls would bounce off his head. Everyone would have a good laugh. During the games, he'd sit on the bench. Or he'd walk up and down the dugout telling everyone in the lineup they were about to get a hit. Or he'd get up and stretch, sure that this was the day he was getting into a game. Every single game. We read, and you can read this in a lot of places. Baseball historians love Victory Fast. We read that the players liked Charlie, liked having him around. They certainly liked winning. He didn't get paid like a player, he didn't have a contract, but he got a per diem. Money for cabs and lunch. People would buy him dinner. They thought he was funny. Although there is that fine line between laughing with and laughing at. They also thought he was lucky. And why wouldn't they? On the days that Victory Faust suited up for New York during their 1911 season, the Giants won 36 games and lost two. But during every one of those games, Charlie was frustrated. Why hadn't he pitched? The fortune teller had been clear, and they're not usually clear, but this one was. He was supposed to pitch the Giants to the World Series. So why weren't they putting him in the game? Every day, every game, he'd ask. And it drove John McGraw crazy. One day he kicked him out of the ballpark. He couldn't take it anymore. But then they lost, and his players wanted him back. And Charlie returned, ready to pitch. Then one day he did. It was late September, and the Giants had a spot in the World Series sewn up. So McGraw sent Charlie to the mound in the ninth inning against the Boston Braves. It was a farce. He was certainly the least qualified athlete to take the mound in the history of the major leagues. Charlie did his windmill thing. The Braves hit him hard, but the Giants outfield took care of him. The last batter he faced was laughing when he grounded to short. Then Charlie was on deck during the bottom of the ninth when the Giants made the last out, but the opposing manager and the umpire decided to let Charlie bat anyway. And everyone had a laugh, and they let him hit and run the bases and leave the field a hero. The Giants lost the World Series. Some of the sports reporters voiced some winking speculation that it may have been because the Philadelphia Athletics had their own good luck charm. A little person with a hunchback named Louis Van Zylst. Players used to rub his hump before they go up to bat. And Charlie went back home to Kansas and showed up the next spring. Said he'd been working out, he'd been learning how to throw with his other arm. He knew they could use another lefty. But McGraw didn't really want him back. The team wouldn't pay for him to go on the road. But he was welcome to do his little act before the home games if he wanted to. They went 54-11 to start out that season. But Charlie was too much. He was more insistent that year, more demanding. Something had turned. It changed with him. He seemed agitated, threatening even. And McGraw told him to leave, and he refused. But some of the players convinced him to go home. They didn't need him right now, they said. But they would. They couldn't win the pennant without him. He should just go back to Kansas, sit tight, and they'd send for him when they needed him. They won the National League again that year, and they lost the series. And they never sent for Charlie. He was confused. The next season, he wrote to McGraw and wrote to the league, demanding a spot in the team. He found his way to Seattle and lived with a brother. But one day in 1914, he walked all the way down to Portland. And someone found him wandering around in a daze, saying how he was trying to find the Giants. He was committed to a state hospital and diagnosed with dementia. And he died of tuberculosis within the year. He was 34. People used to skip that part of the story. They don't anymore. That postscript has been added and expanded as baseball writers and historians have told and retold the story of Charlie Victory Faust. Because history changes, right? Reflects the times in which it was written. In the spirit of the age, some of the best contemporary writing on Charlie Victory Faust tries to take the notion of Charlie as good luck charm seriously, or as seriously as it reasonably can, and wonder at what material advantage his presence may have brought to the New York Giants during the seasons of 1911 and 1912, for they won an extraordinary 80% of their games, played 800 ball when Charlie was there in uniform, sure that this was the day he was going to pitch. And there is probably something to it, if something unquantifiable. Something to the idea that a batter who believes he is lucky no matter the cause, no matter the fact that luck isn't actually a thing, could step up to the plate more relaxed, more present and focused, that his eye could pick out a pitch that little bit better. And why not the same for some pitcher who'd been two in his head for his last two starts, overthinking his delivery and obsessing about arm slot or grip, afraid of contact, but who now suddenly believes that he is destined to win because some fortune teller in Kansas was probably having a laugh at the expense of someone who likely didn't have the capacity to realize it. And so that postscript grows now. This sad ending that makes it impossible to feel entirely good about any of what came before. When the line between laughing at and laughing with, between embracing and exploiting, is so thin and unknowable. But we know, at least as far as we can, at least as far as we can understand things now, that Charlie Faust had an atypical brain. That on some plotted chart of neurological function, of neurodiversity, most of us would be clumped around the center, and Charlie would be off to the side, or way down below, or above, depending on the data points and metrics. He was an atypical human being, who spent the better part of two summers of his too short life with other atypical human beings. Men whose brains could process visual information at astounding speeds, or who had diminished flight response, such that they could remain focused as a ball came way inside at 96 miles an hour. Or who had a higher density of fast twitch muscles in their quadriceps than you and me. Or were otherwise equipped to live lives that you and I can't lead. We know Charlie Faust got out of Kansas and saw America. We know he did pitch for the Giants. We know they won the pennant. We don't know what it meant to him. We know that when he checked into the state hospital, when he was checked in, not long before he died, he was asked to write down what he had done for work. And he wrote down baseball player. And it was true.
I think he was autistic. He sounds, maybe slightly mentally handicapped, but, socially, just not picking up social cues and that sort of thing. But fascinating, right? And again, that's the Memory Palace podcast. Thank you, guys, listeners, if that was interesting. It's actually a really good show. I listen to it all the time. Go check that out. But I think Charles Victory Faust is now in one of my top 10 favorite players of all time. Now with Terrence Gore from the Royals up there, is up there. This guy, I like the Fred Merkel, the Merkel boner. I like, just those random guys. That's who I like. So I don't know. Go check that out. Hope that wasn't too nerdy for you guys. And if it was, then you're not truly a sportsaholic. I'll try to nerd out on other stuff. I threw in hockey earlier. Guys, again, go to Puck Off Podcast. I don't know what you want from me. Let me know. If you want to tell me what you want from me, then let me know. But okay. This is where I'm going to plug myself into the show. Oceanside Tuesday, January 16th, I will be down there, and then up in Gilroy, Northern Central California, south of San Jose, Thursday at the District Theater, Thursday, January 18th. I'll be there with Davey Wester, Doc Willis, and the very funny Jen Murphy. Just go to johnishere.com. You can find out all that information. And again, one last time, if you're in Southern California, La Jolla, go to Don Carlos Taco Shop at Eat a Burrito. On Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff. If you're hungry, you love beer, go to regrained.com, regrained.com. Very good protein snack bars, whatever. They're delicious. Just buy them. And then if you need any shirts printed up, anything like that, go to unionpresskc.com. That's unionpresskc.com. Thanks to all the guests this week. Eric, great to hear your voice again, man. We'll talk soon for sure. Leading out, this is going to be The Roots, one of my favorite bands. I mean, this definitely, now that I'm an old man in my mid-30s, this is one of those from your teen songs that you're like, oh man, this song's already 14, 15 years old. Yes, The Roots, The Seed is already 14, 15 years old and it's still bad as shit. Enjoy. Guys, stay obsessed.
My